Welcome to the Learning Can't Wait podcast, a Full Mind production. At Full Mind, our vision is to ensure every child has access to an exceptional education. Each episode, we will be joined by pathfinders within and around the education space who are bringing about transformational change on behalf of deserving students. I am your host, Haley Spierbauer. Welcome back, everybody, to the Learning Can't Wait podcast. I have an incredible guest today whom I have looked up to for longer than I think I acknowledged the first time we met. It is the former co-CEO and superintendent of Achievement First, who is now a consultant, Doug McCurry. Welcome, Doug.
Oh, it's great to be here.
It's so great to have you on. As I kind of fangirled the first time we talked, I grew up in the charter movement of New York City. And so to meet you, the founder, co-founder of Achievement First, is a true honor. And I'm so grateful to have you on the podcast to share some of your experiences in education.
Oh, great to be here.
So Doug, I am very curious, as are our listeners, how did you come to be the personal and professional version of yourself?
What a great question. I really think about different people that I've copied, emulated, et cetera, over the years. I often say to folks that, like, I'm not as great at coming up of ideas of my own, but I'm really good at, like, watching people and learning from them and trying to take the best of that. And so a lot of me actually starts with my dad, who actually just passed away last year, but was a giant in my life. And I really learned optimism, humor, and generosity from my dad. And those are qualities I try to keep in leadership. You know, he was a guy who actually grew up in an orphanage from age 4 to 13, but kind of you would have thought would come out with, you know, I don't know, bitterness, resentment, whatever, but always just came out. He always would talk about people and things in the most positive way. We'd go to an Applebee's, and my dad would say, "That was the greatest restaurant we've ever been to. I love that meal." I'd be like, "Dad, it was an Applebee's." And he always was super generous with his time, with his resources to others. And he ran a medical distributorship, different industry, but I watched him and kind of learned, this is how you can kind of treat people well. This is how, even in the face of really big challenges, you can maintain joy and optimism and generosity. And that's always been kind of a really important kind of piece for me. I was also lucky enough to co-found Achievement First with Daisha Toll, who's kind of a powerhouse leader. And she is just the most can-do, optimistic, let's go at it. Okay, there's a problem, let's go. I always laugh. I loved meeting with Daisha because she does this thing where she, like, snaps with her fingers. And I just knew if she's snapping, we're going. And so I just appreciated that and kind of just kept building in me this idea that doing anything big, especially what we tried to do at Achievement First, you know, run great charter schools at scale, you're going to have problems. You're going to get conflict. You're going to have obstacles, right? And just that unfailing belief that, like, we can and we will do it. I think, you know, those folks. And then kind of, like, recently, over the last decade or so, my life's been a lot shaped by my son, Matthew, who has autism, pretty profound autism. And he's super smart, can communicate by typing, but can't really speak in conversational ways. And just watching him and his journey and the resilience that he's had and, you know, what my wife and I are doing and what he's doing, that's also just kind of double clicked for me on resilience as resilience and, again, optimism as keys. So I'm talking in broad leadership strokes, right? Because I do think at the end of the day, it's those things that have mattered and propelled me, even though I've done different types of roles.
Well, first of all, thank you for sharing some stories and anecdotes about people in your life who have been really influential in the course of how you've become who you are. Your father, I'm sorry about his loss. He sounds like a really incredible human, and as does your son.
Thank you.
And your co-CEO, Daisha. These are all people in various ways who have shaped you as a person, much the way educators shape the students that they teach. Can you talk a little bit about, I am curious, this is personal interest for sure, about how Achievement First came to be?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it first started, Daisha was in law school in New Haven with a group of folks and noticed, you know, we just kept seeing the challenges of New Haven public schools. And she actually did some student teaching while she was in law school and had the idea and kind of brought a community group together and wrote the charter. I was then at graduate school at Teachers College Columbia, and I knew Daisha in undergrad. We both went to the University of North Carolina together. And so we kind of hooked up to then kind of co-do this thing, you know, even from the very first school we started, you know, I was kind of more of the academic leader. She did the fundraising and external and all of that. And more or less, that's what we did along the way. I always say that, like, you know, I was probably 80-20 academics, 20% external. She was also kind of flipped, and we did a little bit in each other's lane. But yeah, and that it started with in New Haven as a small charter school with 84 kids. You know, I did everything from teaching fifth grade to serving tater tots at lunch and everything you do, and grew that from, you know, 84 kids to, you know, over, I think, 16,000 kids Achievement First now has. Those very first years, we were able to get success relatively early. The first group of kids, they used to only do the state test every 2 years, bizarrely, in Connecticut back then. But so we waited a year, and when our kids took the state test, they did like extraordinarily well. I remember one time we did a field trip to New York, and we were taking the bus from our kids in New Haven, and we passed Greenwich. And I remember saying to the kids, those poor kids in Greenwich, they didn't do as well as you guys in math. There's such an achievement gap. I feel so bad for those kids in Greenwich. Let's maybe stop by on the way back and tutor them in math. And the kids just thought it was hilarious, in my dad kind of joke kind of way. Yeah.
There's that humor from your father.
Yeah.
And now, obviously, Achievement First is a very large network. Shout out to my former roommate and regional superintendent, Kevin Loella, who did not bring us together, but would be happy to know that we are.
Yeah, Kevin, one of my favorite all-time AFers.
Education is a really challenging environment. And you look at people like Kevin and you wonder, and you have such, I wonder, and I have such awe for how he has sustained this work, school-based work, for so many years. In your leadership, you obviously have seen a lot of change. What do you say? What do you think, as you reflect, maybe from a 30,000 foot level, are some of the biggest changes to education today that you've witnessed?
Wow, that's a huge question. I mean, a few things jump to mind. That may be obvious. I really think the advent of cell phones has changed kids dramatically. I mean, there's such compelling research. You see almost a straight line correlation to where ubiquity of smartphones, as it went up, student mental health went down. And so that was already on the stage. And then the pandemic had both mental health issues and lost learning issues. So those have been two, you know, like huge, huge times. The other thing is, you know, paradoxically, when the job market as a whole is good for the broader economy, it's bad for education. In the sense, it's like you know, paradoxically, when we have recessions, more talented people go into teaching, and it is so that it's this coupled. We've had a huge mental health issues that we were not facing in the past, coupled with harder time finding talented folks to go into education. And those two things often can go together because it's more challenging. And then I'm seeing schools just kind of in death spirals of they're not where they want to be. So their people aren't happy. So their people are leaving. And they just can't escape that in a way that that was much more challenging than it was even a decade ago.
I cannot imagine. I was actually in a school 2 days ago in New York City, a high school, and the kids had cell phones and they were actively on them in classes. And I was thinking back to when I taught middle school and really out of touch with how challenging that must be to be a classroom teacher today, competing with cell phones, both understanding what you named here, the impact on a student's well-being and mental health. Those are connected to the mental health crisis we see in kids today. APA, I think, recommended, or maybe it was the physicians or psychologists, not giving kids cell phones till like 16.
Yeah.
To the significant impact it has on their health. I can't even fathom what it must be like being a leader or a teacher today competing with cell phones in the classroom.
And I say this with all love and respect for school leaders out there, but it's a failure of school leadership to go into a school and kids are all on their cell phones. Like at some level, I think we're often asking teachers to be individual enforcers of these types of things, right? And that would drive me crazy if I were a teacher and my principal said, well, it's kind of up to you. And I was like, we need to create like the conditions where across the school that learning is sacred. I mean, I sometimes see it, you know, I work with different groups and my wife is also a consultant, kind of expert in multilingual learners. And we work with different groups and we even see that sometimes with adults, you know, and I'm really big at setting a, hey, this is a tech-free zone. And some groups are awesome. Like they're completely focused with us and jamming. And there are groups of grownups who can't be in a professional development for 30 minutes without checking their phone constantly. And I can't imagine them leading classrooms that are anything different than that. And that's just not good for kids.
Let's talk about some bright spots, right? I think a lot of our I'm where you are. Like there's so many things that we look at with schools and we're like, wow, that's really hard. And I have the deepest, most profound respect for educators who endured the past 4 years of trauma on trauma during the pandemic. But what are some things that you're looking at schools today and you're like, this evolution is so pro-social or so pro-academic. Like what could we be excited about that's happening?
Yeah. There's a couple of things that these are a little, they're a little geeky, but I'm super excited about curriculum. I feel like, whereas if I'm worried about cell phones or student mental health, over the last 5 to 10 years, I think we've realized that while there are some superhuman teachers who can create amazing curriculum that exactly meets the needs of their kids, the vast majority of schools and teachers need and welcome the support of a really high quality curriculum. And so that has been something I'm seeing kind of schools adopting that. And that makes a huge difference, that kids having access to grade level, high quality curriculum makes a really big difference. And then likewise, I'm seeing both on the academic side, but also kind of SEL providers, there's more quality stuff out there and more buzz. And I think schools are saying, hey, we need to put aside some time and we need to have rich advisory programs, et cetera, to think about kind of the mental health and SEL side. And then that needs to be integrated clearly through the day. But then also, kids in every single class, we should guarantee that they have access to like quality curriculum. And that was just not the case 5 to 10 years ago. And then, I think with science of reading also being, kind of a really positive, aligned to curriculum thing. I mean, this was something 2 decades ago at AF, we were doing structured phonics. And I think that was one of the reasons, like we always said to families, hey, your kindergartner is going to learn to read. I remember showing data to people where, 92% of our second graders were at or above grade level in reading. And they were saying that data is false. It's not true. It's whatever. It's like, no, it is. It's because like we are doing what research says.
Took a while for everybody else to catch up.
Yeah,
yeah, no,
exactly.
you're for sure that's a bright spot. And I hate to do this, but I have to ask you. So where do we find good high quality curriculum? Because I just read an article not even 2 weeks ago that Ed Reports is pivoting, which was really a lot of people's touchstone to rate curriculum. So how does Doug McCurry qualify content for schools?
Yeah, this is tricky, right? I look for a few things. I mean, one is deep standards alignment, and standards can get trickier because the Common Core is slowly decimated, right? But does the curriculum align to the level of rigor that the standards articulate for kids in that grade? I actually look a lot more for simplicity than other people do. I'm not a fan of curricula that has five different components on each day or four different lesson types. It's like that means there's 20 different things that teachers have to figure out. Like I'm more of a fan of days. There's a few core types of lessons, and days are relatively similar. So as a teacher and a kid, I can really hit the ground running. And jam. I look for curriculum that have a proven track record of success. Like, I mean, that's essentially where we often, started was, does this curriculum have a track record of dramatic results serving similar student population that I'm serving? And, when you start to triangulate those, you can more and more kind of get down to, what may work.
You name that you're really big on simplicity. And right now we're in a bit of a boom, an innovation boom around technology and change in schools. How do you feel about this innovation boom? What gets you really excited about it, but what also makes you concerned about it?
Yeah. Look, innovation overall, is a good thing. I'm pro innovation. But innovation for innovation's sake, is where I sometimes like innovation in of itself, that's what we're going after. I feel like we can sometimes lose the sight of at the heart of schools is teaching and learning, right? Like that is the heartbeat of schools. And whatever we're doing should be supporting great teaching and learning. And that should be our focus. And yes, there's some other things around the side. But if what we're doing is not directly going at that. And so, yeah, like I think, in the zeal to do a lot of other things, we can sometimes lose sight of just fundamentals. I mean, speaking of research, there's a lot of research out there that shows like the number one determinant in a classroom to achievement is the level of student focus in the classroom. And like people don't want to hear like classroom management is not as sexy as the new thing. But the reality is, if we don't have our kids feeling like they belong and motivating them to do focused work, then it doesn't matter what other thing that we have around it. And so the work that I'm doing a lot of work with schools is really helping them first just make sure just some of the basic structure. And so that's on the instructional side, but also just some of the basic structures and systems. Like, does every teacher know what their goals are? Does every leader do people have clear roles and responsibilities? Like, does every teacher have a coach that meets with them and they know at 1:12 on Wednesdays in the conference room, I meet with my coach, right? Is there regular professional development happening? And does that follow a sequence and not just drive by PD, right? Like those things really matter. And then, we also try to help schools with what we call the arc of the year, because a year follows a natural flow. You start the year and you want to make sure you have a strong classroom environment. And then you want to make sure that like teachers are really intellectually preparing for classes so they have the level of rigor. And then you want to make sure that like kids are getting great feedback on their work, right? And then you want to deepen thinking in the classrooms. And then you want to crescendo to the end of year assessment. And like that's a natural flow, which has its own coaching focus. And if you can help teachers and leaders like kind of embrace that simplicity, like, you know what? In this 6 weeks at the beginning of the year, we're going to make sure that every single classroom in this school has focused learning where kids feel loved and respected. Great. Now we're going to make sure that every single teacher in this building is doing high quality intellectual prep on their curriculum over the next 6 weeks. Like, that's powerful, but it's like simple and focused, and it's not 100 things that are going on. It's that. And I feel like we've gotten away a little bit from that as schools. And we've gotten away, honestly, a little bit from achievement. I think, while the pendulum was probably too much, like, you know, test scores were everything. It was kind of like, it became like, well, there's 1,000 things that matter. It's like, no, like, it really does matter if kids learn reading and math and science. Like, that really does matter. And we need to put that a little bit more in the driver's seat than we are right now.
One would say maybe a good school name would be achievement.
Achievement first. Exactly. Exactly.
You know, Doug, I hear you sharing a lot about professional development and sentiments. Educator sentiments about PD on a national scale are pretty low. Teachers I don't remember the exact statistic, but I will share it when I share this podcast so that I don't look like a complete fraud. But I remember reading that, you know, generally speaking, educators had trouble with the offered PD at their school. So what I hear you saying in the podcast right now is that it should be focused. It can be small. It should be consistent. It should be predictable. What do you do with schools? I'm going to transition us a little bit to talk about summer learning, because I love summer learning, both for kids and for teachers. What do you recommend schools do in the summer with their teachers? We're like around the corner from those beautiful, beautiful, glorious summer days.
In summer, I work really closely with an organization called the National Summer School Initiative. It's one of the co-founders and still do some work with them. And I think what we've done at NSSI is really smart, because it solves two of the problems we just were talking about during the school year. One is there's an exceptional, simple, easy to use curriculum in reading and math that is aligned to the power standards for that next grade and subject level. And so if you're a kid, like, that's what we're going to focus on. And then the second is we see summer as a great teacher development opportunity, that instead of like putting some worksheets and putting kids on a computer and calling it summer school, we're like, look, we're going to make summer the best 6 weeks of the year. Like, we're going to do a 2-day to 4-day intensive training of your teachers before the summer. And then we're going to meet weekly in subject teams, grade subject teams. So you're going to be meeting with, you know, third grade math teachers from across the country. And so that's like basically have a super high quality summer specific curriculum, and then have really excellent grade and subject level training. We do that at NSSI. A district hypothetically could do that themselves, but I just find that oftentimes districts and charter networks, like, summer is like 15th down the list. And so finding a really trusted partner can be a smart way to do that.
I love that. And I know that, you know, I was just talking to a girlfriend last week whose kid was put in summer school, and she's like, what do you think I should do? I was like, you should take it.
Right. You know, right.
It's so hard because, you know, we think back to our childhood, and very often summer meant being out in the sun, being by water, if we could, like, not having a care in the world in many cases, hopefully not having a care in the world during summer. So it's hard to imagine what a great summer program could look like. I really want summer to be an opportunity for kids to explore interests too.
That's right.
Like getting their hands in science and really doing a focused science study over the course of a couple weeks, not, you know, a one-off lab, but the opportunity to really study a subject and study it deeply. I think that so often our school days are packed with, our schedules are packed, right? Teachers and school leaders, they have one activity, they have one lesson, then the next lesson, then they have this activity. And so it's hard to fit in like learning and making learning fun. So I love the focus of NSSI and how there's so much of that incorporated.
Yeah. I mean, riffing off something you said, I'm a huge believer. Hopefully most summer schools also are just like what I'm talking about, core academic is like a morning, and then afternoon there's, you know, all sorts of enrichment. Just for the, you know, parents or others out there, Something I really highly recommend is a group called Rock by Rock. Is Jeff Emmerich, who was a former AFer, started, and it's basically project-based units in science for elementary age kids that can be done at the home or in school. And they're really cool units around great questions. And so it's a great way over the summer at a different time to, as you said, like kind of go deeper in something rather than just doing a one-off lab.
I had never heard of that organization. So that's a new to me one. And I'm so excited to explore it.
Great.
And probably adapt some of what I can find for my own kiddos at home.
Love it.
Let's take a good idea, bring it home for them. You know, Doug, I imagine that in the role you serve today, working with all types of schools, you really have a keen view on what are, sorry, I'm going back to an earlier topic, which is what you talked about with retaining teachers and teacher talent and the challenge that schools have today in ensuring their teachers are connected and happy and all of that. What are some, like, what do you think schools do right? Schools that are successful, even when they're in challenging circumstances, to retain talent?
That is a great question. So I'm working with all these schools. One great thing is talent retention is actually on the rise at overall at all of them, which I'm very happy about. But in particular, there's one school that just has had off the charts talent. And I was been coaching this principal, and she's transformed the school in 1 year. And so excited working with her. Her name's Tequila. And I asked her, and I was like, you know, I just really want to better, let's unpack like what you're doing. Because one day I was there and she's like, oh, I'm so sorry. We had someone call out today. And she's like, we've only had 4 call outs all year. And I was like, 4 call outs all year? She's like, yeah, it's a small school. They have like 15 teachers, but like their staff just like most schools I'm talking about have 4 call outs a day or more. And like, it's just hard. So, you know, I talked to her and I think what she said resonates with what I think works, which is one, she celebrates a lot. And so, you know, pretty much every day we'll go around putting little notes on teachers, just saying, hey, amazing thing I saw today, even like in the hallway, just like awesome job, so-and-so, like notice and celebrate. Like people just want to be seen. And they want to know this is like a really hard job and I'm the leader and I see you. I see you busting your chops there, first year teacher with those fourth graders who are hard. I see you, veteran AP history teacher, like running that amazing discourse. I'm with you. I see you, right? Like just acknowledging that is huge. The second is listen. So, you know, she, even though she doesn't coach every single person, she makes it a habit of like on a monthly basis, just going around and just asking people, hey, how's it going? Is there anything, brief survey after each PD that has a block that we've helped people do, just, you know, help rank how happy you are and anything, is there anything getting in your way? And then just try to knock that down. Sometimes it's as simple as like, I don't have any chart paper in my class to do the visual anchors and it's driving me crazy. Right. And like you solve that for people. That kind of goes to take away the nonsense. Like a lot of the stuff that we like ask, you know, submit your lesson plans every week by X time that you don't look at, you know, do, you know, these, you know, duties that we're overstaffed for, right? Like try to keep people's job to like intellectual prepping, looking at student work and teaching. The more you can do that, I think the final thing, and this is counterintuitive to people because this is what they're not doing, is coach the ham sandwich out of people, right? And so she is coaching more like we have regular weekly coaching. She does 2 hours a day of real-time coaching. If a teacher's struggling, she's grabbing them after school and having them work more. And people are in this death loop, right, where people are struggling and they're worried about them struggling. So they're not giving them any feedback. And then they're struggling more. And then they're more unhappy and then they call out sick. And then the other people call out sick because there's too many people out and it's stressful. Like that's the loop we're in versus I see you, I'm celebrating you, I'm listening to you. I'm taking away all the nonsense and I'm going to help you get great. And if you're struggling today in the fourth grade, I'm going to make sure by tomorrow you're struggling a little bit less and you have momentum. And so when people feel like they're growing and supported, that they can do their jobs and the person has their back, that they see them, they appreciate them, and celebrate you, they actually, in this school, this is a Milwaukee school that's 98% low income school with all the challenges, like they are jamming. Achievement is up, attendance is up, all that stuff. And a lot of it's because of this talent cycle, but that's what people aren't doing. And they're scared to give feedback because their people are tired, but that's just making them more tired.
Okay, so this is really concrete, tangible advice for school leaders, which leads me to my last question, which is the perfect setup. Thanks for doing that. Didn't expect it, but really, that was like amazing, amazing tangible advice. I both love to talk theoretically and about reality because people are listening and hopefully enacting some of these ideas in their daily practice. But what advice, Doug, would you give an educator starting their career today? And we could say teacher here specifically.
Yeah. Have a few things. First, find the best teacher in the building, right? And sit in the back of their classrooms during your prep periods, right? And then have them be your informal coach, right? And just talk to them, listen to them, figure it out. The second is really work on your classroom management. Like if you can manage a classroom, it's just so much easier. Like everything else flows from that. And so get feedback. Don't be defensive. Practice, you know, like just say, and be willing to say, hey, I'm really struggling, right? These two boys aren't listening to me at all. I'm trying this and it's not working. Which kind of leads me, win over your toughest kids outside of class. So it's hard to win them over inside of class, but you can win them over outside of class. You can go to lunch. If they're into something, talk to them about it. Like let them
stare deeply into their eyes as they tell you about Minecraft. Just like
exactly.
Not break eye contact.
Don't break eye contact. Tell them. You may not understand, but you're like, yes. And if they talk about Minecraft, you go home and you download Minecraft and you learn it and you come back the next day and you ask them a question about Minecraft. Right. And so that I would say, those are like kind of three big things that I think really help a lot. And then just the other would be, over-prepare. When you walk into classrooms prepared, both like technically prepared, I have all my copies and all that, but intellectually prepared, like I know the content, I know the great answer I'm looking at. I know what I'm going to say. If the student says this, you just feel so much more confident.
That is some amazing, amazing advice. I would love to say thank you for you coming and joining the podcast today. And also thank you to the universe for making this happen, because I'm so excited to hear from you, both your like ethos and your practical beliefs. And so it's been an honor having you on here today, Doug.
Oh, it was a joy, Haley. Thank you.
And thank you to everybody who joined us.
Thanks for listening to the Learning Can't Wait podcast. If you like what you heard, please rate, review, and share this episode. Be the first to know when we have a new episode by subscribing wherever you listen to podcasts. If you'd like to be a guest on the show or have a suggestion for an episode, email us at podcast@fullmindlearning.com.